Committee on Civil Law is now in session. We have, as you know, two bills set for public hearing and three for work session. We'll start out with House Bill 2499, and I will open a public hearing on that bill. I have a representative to testify. Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative, District 48. Just to give you a little background on this, I had a constituent call me who has two children, and she's divorced and is receiving child support payments from the father of the children. And the one is about to turn 18 years old, and he attends, according to her, and I believe her, he attends high school regularly, but he's not a great academic, and he does not average a C grade point. And apparently her husband, ex-husband, is already looking into ways, according to statute, if the young person isn't maintaining a C average, he doesn't have to pay child support anymore on that child. Now, I was not a great student, I confess, but I didn't graduate from high school and even college, where I was not much of a better student. But the whole idea behind this is, if this kid's going to school, he's trying, his mom's feeding him, paying the light bill, doing all that stuff, I think that should be enough, and the man should, or in any case, other parents should continue to pay child support. Once the young person gets out of high school and goes to college, that's a different story. I think if you're not trying, maybe you should try and find something else to do with your time and efforts, and you should get a job and help your mother or your father, whoever it is your state you're living with. That was the whole thing behind this bill. It came for me from a constituent. I think it's fair. I don't know why we should penalize the parent just because their child isn't the greatest academic. So there's any, I just want to let you know what brought it here. I personally think it's a good idea. I hope you see some merit to it. And if you have any questions about it, I'd be happy to try and my best to answer it.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions from the committee for the representative?
I did have a question.
Yeah, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler. Thank you for bringing this bill. I find it interesting. Can you give us some background of when the requirement was put into child support statutes regarding grade point averages or grade levels?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I try to stay away from these subjects as much as I possibly can. To answer your question, no, I cannot. I have not done that research. I do not know the history.
I know there was, Representative, a sequence that first imposed the child support obligation if you were a child attending school from 18 to 21, but that was basically school and college and university. Then later, there was a requirement that the student had to maintain a C average, and failing that, the child support could terminate. But that's sort of a history, but I don't have the timelines on that. But obviously it appears that there was a glitch in terms of the high school setting for students who are deserving of child support.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions of the witnesses? The witness. Well, thank you for your testimony. You're the only witness to testify today. So we appreciate your testimony. And on that basis, I will close the...
Can I say one more
thing? You're pointing your finger at me.
I'm not, Mr. Chair. I'm just... I guess I've been around my Sicilian wife too long to talk my hands. I just want to be really clear. If there's a young person who's 18 years old living in a parent's home and they're not going to school, then they can go out and get a job. But if they are making a good faith effort, they are in school every day, and they're just, for whatever reason, not a good student, and maybe they need to work on that, I don't see why we should penalize that parent who's paying for that child's food and clothing, housing, and all the stuff that a good parent pays for. I wouldn't penalize him or her, whichever the case may be. But I do appreciate you giving me the time to come here and testify.
Fine. We appreciate your testimony. Anyone else
Thank you.
Willing to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I will close the...
Shane, do you
want to... Oh, I'm sorry. Did I miss somebody?
For the record, my name is Shani Fuller. I'm with the Department of Justice Oregon Child Support Program. And just in answer to representative's questions, Chair Ackerman, the The C-grade average was put into statute in 1997, and it does apply to all students, including high school students. We, the child support program, defined that in rule for 18-year-olds when they're still in high school as either a per-term or a cumulative grade average, but when they do get into college, that is a cumulative grade average. There isn't a lot of guidance in statute. I think it says the equivalent of... I forget the exact terminology, but it isn't clear whether it's a cumulative, and that's how we define it in rule, but allow that leniency for a high school student.
Fine, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Further testimony, questions, Representative McPherson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're all a little curious as to what the policy drivers are for the current statute, and I'm assuming that it is because we're trying to require that a student who is after the age of 18 and is in school is serious about their studies for the non-custodial parent to be required to pay for the support of that child in the educational program, in effect. Is that the policy that's behind this?
That is correct, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. In 1997, the child support program actually brought that bill in to get rid of the child attending school statute because it is a workload impact for us. Those are contentious cases. And the legislature at that time made the choice that they still wanted that provision there, but they wanted some more stringent requirements about what was required for a child to get child support. And they heard from constituents that maintaining a grade average was a problem, and they wanted the parent to be able to see the courses that the child was attending, and that there be some reporting requirements that the parent be able to get that information. And those additional requirements have turned out to be, there are some, quite frankly, some enforcement problems around those as well. And there is another comprehensive bill that we'll be dropping on this topic that will make some further changes. So you want to consider that as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Girard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you have any idea how many adults lose child support because a student hasn't maintained the C average?
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, I do not know, although in response to another bill we pulled statistics, and this would be from 18 to 21 years old, any child who did not comply with the requirements and had their support turned off for that reason, and I believe the number was somewhere around 7,000.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. Any further witnesses wishing to testify on this bill? Hearing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2499 and open a work session on that bill. Committee members, President Girard.
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
Excuse me?
Are you ready for a motion?
I am ready.
I would move House Bill 2499 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
President Girard has moved that the House Bill 2499 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion with respect to the committee members? Seeing none, ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Worthless, Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2499 has received a majority vote and will be forwarded to the full committee for the due pass recommendation. And with that, I'll close the work session.
Full carrier.
Excuse me.
Full carrier.
President Girard will be the carrier. With that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2499. And I will open a public hearing on the next bill, House Bill 2873. On the sign-up sheet for this, I noticed that that the proponents have several names here and have indicated they want to appear as a panel, and that's certainly fine. I don't know how many of you are here, but the panel of proponents would like to come forward. We'll take your testimony first. Looks like I got four. That's great. Okay. You may testify in any order you wish. Just let us know. We need your name and address for the record. You may proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with AOI, and we're here today to testify in support of House Bill 2873. And we appreciate the opportunity to be here and that you've scheduled this bill for a hearing. I've brought with me some individuals who have experience with this particular law, and I'll have them present the reasons behind the bill. It's, but I want to make it clear that AOI supports the employment of people with disabilities. And what we are asking here today is for you to consider some concerns that some of the smallest employers have had addressing their obligation. And we intend today to listen to the opposition and take their concerns into consideration. And we're looking at ways to make something that would work for everyone's needs. And we've found that in other areas of business, we've successfully established positive incentives, and we're looking for that sort of resolution this session. I'll briefly introduce each of them and then each of my witnesses, and then turn it over to them, and the questions could maybe follow after that. First will be Ben Featherston, who's a partner, and Clark Lindauer Featherston here in Salem. Then we have Paul Ostroff, who's a shareholder at Lane Powell, and then Richard Minigiello with Fisher Phillips in Portland. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ben. Thank you.
Fine. I appreciate your statement. And the way we'll proceed, we'll hear everybody out on the panel before we take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. As Lisa Trussell indicated, my name is Ben Featherston. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. My practice consists principally of representing both small and large companies, and from that experience I know firsthand the desire of all of my clients to comply with the law. Prior to that, I was a lawyer in Portland. I practiced in a firm doing plaintiffs' personal injury law. And from that experience, I learned firsthand and know the challenges and obstacles that are faced by individuals with disabilities and the courage that's shown by individuals with disabilities in the workplace. I'm not here to represent any interest other than my own interest in public policy. I'm not here to urge the repeal of the protection afforded to individuals with disabilities under either state or federal law. And similarly, I don't think anybody is here to urge that the exemption for small employers under state law or federal law is not supported by sound policy, and no one is suggesting that the exemption should therefore be repealed. Both state and federal law recognize the special burdens and unique hardships that the law places on smaller employers, and both laws therefore exempt smaller employers. Under the federal law, those are employers employing 15 or fewer employees, or rather I should say more accurately, fewer than 15 employees. And under state law, currently employers employing fewer than 6 employees. The existence of these exemptions recognize the existence of the burdens and hardships of compliance on smaller employers. The small employer exemption recognizes that the law is attempting to balance here clearly the benefits of the law on the one hand against the burdens placed on smaller employers on the other hand. I believe that the public policy reasons for the existence of the exemption for small employers at 15 employees under federal law are equally applicable to Oregon employers. I don't see a sound justification for concluding that Oregon employers with fewer than 15 employees are better able to assume the burdens or face the hardships of compliance with this law. The challenge facing smaller Oregon employers is particularly acute because the regulations interpret the six-employee threshold to count part-time employees and seasonal employees. And as a consequence, this reaches to very small employers who, for example, in my experience, may have the equivalent of three full-time employees, but they have part-time employees, each of which are counted to meet the threshold of six employees. And with that, I'll turn it over to my other panelists here and be prepared to answer any questions you might have of me. Thank you.
Fine. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, pardon me, members of the committee. My name is Paul Ostroff. I'm a partner at the Lane Powell Law Firm, and I specialize in representing employers predominantly in labor and employment matters, and have handled and advised employers, both large and small, concerning the application of both the federal ADA as well as the analogous provisions of Oregon law. I want to impart to you a perspective from really three vantage points. First of all, from the perspective of the legislative history of ORS 659A 100.100 at SEC. Secondly, how it has been applied to small employers and the impact that it has on small employers in ways that I think were never really fully understood or perhaps never contemplated by the legislature. And third, how the law is now being interpreted and applied by the Oregon Court of Appeals in ways that were probably never intended or anticipated by the legislature. When in 1997, you adopted amendments to our statute to, in essence, model it on the ADA, so that there were certain understandings in place when the law was amended in 1997, and may have been the basis for the then retention of the six employee threshold. But the manner in which the law is now being applied, I think, highlights the tremendous burden that it now places on small employers in this state in ways that I think can be mitigated by the proposed legislation. In short, we believe that this amendment will allow the legislature to complete the job which I believe it set out to do in 1997 when it consciously adopted the ADA model and embodied that in ORS 659A.139. It might be helpful to look first at what the record was before Congress when it adopted the ADA in 1990. And I think it's instructive in informing your judgment about why adoption of the 15-employee threshold under the ADA makes good policy sense. There was substantial testimony before Congress of, first of all, small profit margins affecting small companies. The congressional committees heard testimony that sometimes small businesses average revenues of less than $350,000 per year, and so that the impact, the compliance impact, was substantial. Congress also heard testimony, and of course here we're talking about late 1980 numbers, of the cost of accommodation and how it impacted smaller operations. For example, $1,000 to $10,000 for a concrete ramp, $3,000 for widening doors, $23 an hour to hire a certified sign language reporter, $250 a page to translate written text into Braille. These are late 1980 figures. We can adjust them upward for inflation. And I would simply ask you to do the math, because had I been a better math student, I would have become an accountant instead of a lawyer. So looking at that baseline and the recognition on the part of Congress that there were these sorts of substantial impacts on small companies. It adopted implicitly the 15 employee threshold, and we believe it makes sense for Oregon to conform our statute to that same threshold because of the legislature's stated intent to largely model our statute on the ADA. But let me point out to you some ways in which our statute has been interpreted by the Oregon Court of Appeals in ways that substantially broaden that impact and impose greater burdens. In other words, accentuating these burdens upon smaller employers. The Oregon Court of Appeals has twice indicated that notwithstanding ORS 659A.139, it did not consider itself bound to interpretations of the ADA that took place after 1997. The effect of that has been that in a very recent case, the Oregon Court of Appeals held that an employer, in this case it happened to be a larger employer, was required to reasonably accommodate an employee's use of medical marijuana. Now, for a small employer that may have consciously and very conscientiously adopted a no-tolerance policy, this creates an inordinate problem. The Oregon Court of Appeals has also held that the definition of disability under the ADA is not to be applied, that the definition of disability may be substantially broader under state law than under the ADA. Now, how may this play out in terms of the application of the law to small companies? Oftentimes, the problem is not paying $50 to modify a chair, because most companies, all things are, that is not going to be deemed an unreasonable accommodation. The real problems are in the intangible areas, such as providing leaves of absence, restructuring job schedules and restructuring jobs, which for a small company can can impose managerial problems that oftentimes become insurmountable. Consider this scenario. An employer that comes under the current 6-employee threshold, but in fact regularly employs 3 or perhaps 4 employees, is suddenly called upon to accommodate a request by an employee for intermittent leave or a leave of absence. A leave of absence connotes that the employee would be reinstated at the end of that leave. A small company may not be able to effectively recruit an employee to fill that position on any sort of a temporary basis, and in fact may have to promise or at least not misrepresent to prospective applicants that the position is for a limited term. The restructuring of employee schedules, the shifting of job duties can also cause a great strain on a small organization which may only have 3 or 4 employees. And I give you those as probably examples that most people don't think of from a common sense standpoint when dealing with the ADA, but it's probably one of the most vexing and difficult problems for small companies. I would last like to point out that the legislature has recognized in other analogous contexts employee coverage thresholds that are substantially higher than the 6-employee threshold in the current law. Two good examples are the Oregon Family Leave Act, which only applies to companies that have at least 25 employees, and the second is the 21-employee threshold that applies to the reemployment obligation that must be extended to employees who have had a work-related injury. So when we sit here before you today and ask you to simply carry out the job that we think the legislature had in mind in 1997, we're asking you to conform the statute to the requirements of the ADA insofar as that coverage threshold is concerned, but also asking you to apply the law in a way that the legislature has previously recognized in analogous contexts makes sense. In other words, smaller organizations have to have some degree of relief in these areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Richard Menegello, and I'm a partner in the Portland area law firm of Fisher & Phillips. We are a national law firm with 14 offices across the country, and of our 200 attorneys across the country, all of us exclusively practice in the areas of labor and employment law, and we exclusively represent employers. So we I can present to you a unique perspective, much like the two previous attorneys who've testified from the perspective of the employer. I can bring another unique perspective to this committee in that I was fortunate enough to be the lead associate counsel on a case that went all the way from the local federal court in Oregon to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to the United States Supreme Court in 1999, the case of Albertsons versus Kirkenberg, where we ensured that the Supreme Court gave a fair interpretation of the ADA. And one of the reasons that I'm here today is that, as Mr. Ostroff just testified, the Oregon Court of Appeals has recently handed down a case, Washburn versus Columbia River Forest Products, that essentially eliminated the fair interpretation of the ADA that was passed down in the interpretation of the Oregon statute. Even though the Oregon Disability Discrimination Statute does say it should be construed to the extent possible consistent with the ADA, the Oregon Court of Appeals has recently expanded that, as Mr. Ostroff just testified. So I can testify that that's something that harms employers, and I do not think the Oregon legislature intended that. Of my practice, I try to concentrate on the disability discrimination angle. I'm the past chair of the Oregon State Bar Disability Law Executive Committee, and I spend much of my day answering questions from employers. Even though a good part of my practice is defending lawsuits, at least 25% of my day is spent answering questions from employers who want to comply with the law and have serious questions about how to comply with it and how to navigate through the sometimes confusing channels that the disability law presents them. Of the questions I get, at least 50% of them have to do with disability law issues, besides all the multitude of other issues that employers have. Because the disability law requirements do infringe upon so many areas that small employers have to deal with. Now, even though I do work in a very large law firm, until the year 2002, our law firm was a standalone shop operating just in Portland, and we had no more than 5 to 7 attorneys for the previous almost 10 years or so. Because of that, we did try to market ourselves towards the smaller employers. So we, even though we did deal with national companies like Albertsons, we also dealt with a lot of small, essentially mom-and-pop operations, so lots of employers with 14 or less employees. These people have these employers have a very difficult time interpreting and applying the disability discrimination law, mostly in the area of reasonable accommodation. These are folks who are handed issues involving employees who need to take unpaid leave for an unknown amount of time, or intermittent leave. They need to take off a day here, a day there. It could crop up in the morning of the absence, or it could be scheduled in advance. It really depends on the situation. These employers found it very difficult and would often present me questions and would commiserate or would try to commiserate with me about the problems they were having complying with the reasonable accommodation law as it applied to unpaid leave or intermittent leave situations. These are very difficult to manage when you have such a small operation. As Mr. Ostroff just testified, even though the Oregon Family Leave Act says that you've got to be 25 employees or more in order to require 3 months of unpaid leave, under the Oregon disability law, such an unpaid leave structure could also be necessary. Now, maybe a court at some point would look at the entire situation and say, it is unreasonable for you as a small entity to have to provide 3 months of leave. But I can tell you that employers cannot afford to get to that point where they have a court making that decision for them. Employers, when they call attorneys up for questions, want to operate in the most conservative fashion that they can in order to avoid litigation. These are companies that cannot afford to take a case through the litigation parameters all the way through a trial. They just simply can't afford to do that, to have a court render a decision for them. They need certainty at the time they're making this decision. And because of this, we have to tell them, I'm not sure how a court is going to interpret that. And a court very well may say that 3 months or more of unpaid leave is going to be reasonable. It's a judgment call that you have to make. Passing this bill would provide certainty to those smaller employers that cannot question whether or not this kind of leave would be something that would be or would not be reasonable. So again, I think the conformity to the federal levels would be a great thing for those smaller employers. Congress has spent time looking into this and into the hard costs and also the soft costs, the resources that would have to be expended in interpreting, applying the statute, and having the leave handed down is something that the Congress has already looked at and said that 15 and those with 15 or more should be subject to it, but those beneath should be exempt. And with that, I'll turn it back over to you, ask any questions of myself or the panel. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, Chair and the members of the committee.
Fine. We appreciate your testimony. Questions from the committee. Representative Garrard.
In Oregon, to be categorized as a small business, what is the maximum number of employees?
That's an excellent question, but I don't think that there's a real touchstone. It looks as though Ms. Trussell may have.
Well, I think it depends on what you're looking at. Only 2% of Oregon employers employ over 100 employees. And it's something like 89% employ up to 50. And then the balance is in that 50 to 100 category. And obviously, the bulk of them are on the smaller end of the spectrum rather than the larger end.
Other questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you. In 1990, Congress adopted the ADA. In 1997, the Oregon legislature enacted legislation to move Oregon to the ADA model. What transpired that Oregon did not bring it at that point then to the 15 employees and applied it to six?
It had been six under the previous statute, and apparently there wasn't an adjustment made, but I think as you've heard, the legal developments that we've seen have demonstrated that the Oregon courts are not going to follow the ADA model. I mean, Oregon Court of Appeals has twice said, we don't, notwithstanding the fact that the legislature in 97 adopted language which said that our statute should be interpreted in a manner consistent with the ADA. In fact, it's actually stronger than that. We don't believe that we're bound by that, at least insofar as interpretations of the ADA that took place that occurred after 1987. And what we've seen over the last 4 to 5 years is a clear move on the part of the Oregon Court of Appeals to broadly expand the meaning of the Oregon statute in ways that certainly go far beyond anything that is required by the ADA. And what that does is that it creates an even greater impact upon small employers in this state. So I hope my response wasn't too long.
I could also add to that, Representative Forrest, Chair Ackerman. I think what you see from the areas of 1990 to 1997 was a period of time in which lawsuits under the ADA flourished. The reason it might look as if, well, it was a 7-year period, it might have taken a while, When the ADA was first passed, there were a couple years first before there would be compliance and lawsuits could occur. I think it was around 1992 or 1993 that the first suits could occur. Lawsuits take a while to bubble their way up through the appellate court level. So by about 1995 or 1996, those of us who practice in the area of employment law were pretty surprised when courts, some of the federal courts in some of the more liberal jurisdictions, were interpreting the ADA very broadly, much more broadly than Congress had originally anticipated. And it took the Court of Appeals on the federal level to begin interpreting it fairly. So around 1996 or 1997 was around the period of time at first where people were getting together saying the ADA was not intended to be this broad. To give you an example, one of the cases that was also on the panel of cases that was heard when my case went to the U.S. Supreme Court was a case where two twin sisters had applied for jobs with United Airlines to try to be pilots. And these women were rejected because under FAA regulations, they did not have 20/20 vision that was uncorrected without their glasses, because the FAA requires that you be able to see essentially perfectly even if your glasses get knocked off while you're flying a plane. They sued under the ADA because they were rejected and tried to claim first that they were, like you need to do in any ADA lawsuit, that they were disabled. And the Court of Appeals, or some of the lower courts, agreed with them and said, yes, because you have nearsightedness, you are disabled. It took the U.S. Supreme Court to say, but wait, if you wear eyeglasses, you're just like, you can see to the extent that most people with common average vision can. There's no way in the world this statute was intended to protect somebody like you. But what you see here is, there were courts in lower jurisdictions who were wanting to grant these people protections, people who were in no way intended to be protected by the ADA. So in the late 90s, you started to see legislatures such as the Oregon legislature and other courts across the country that were starting to give it a more fair interpretation of the ADA. And I believe one of the reasons why that the legislature brought it into mirror compliance, the Oregon statute into mirror compliance with the ADA, was to enable that fair interpretation. And my assumption is that the employer limit was simply overlooked in trying to bring it up to that level.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Searson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to pursue the question that Representative Garrard, I think, was getting at, which is what proportion of all the workforce in Oregon would be removed from protection as a result of making this change? And I realize maybe we don't have the detailed statistics on it, but you were getting at it. But we know that Oregon is a small employer state as a general matter, and that was reflected in the statistics we were given earlier. So I think we need to get some kind of sense here about what, if we're going to take a certain swath of the Oregon workforce out of these protections, how significant is that impact?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, what I'm familiar with are the number of employers in the different categories, and what I don't have is the number of employees, because and that's something that would certainly be valuable to have. Maybe the economic development people have those figures. But although the biggest percentage of employers are in those classifications, that's not where the biggest bulk of the workforce is. The biggest bulk of the workforce is in those employers that employ 100 or more, obviously. So, but that's something that we could try and garner, and either the Employment Department or Economic Development may be able to get us those numbers.
I might interject here. We have witnesses later this morning from the Oregon Disabilities Commission, Labor Commissioner's Office, and Department of Human Services, and you're out in the audience, but you could probably anticipate this will be asked of you. Okay, further questions of the panel? I have just a couple of questions. I just have the statute and the amendment before me. Are there any administrative regulations that define what constitutes six or more employees that we should consider?
Mr. Chairman, Ben Featherston, I can answer that. The regulation I alluded to in my testimony is OAR 839-006-0115, and that's the definition of employer that has been adopted to extend the scope of counting employees to part-time and seasonal employees as well as full-time employees. In other words, the regulation says that when you're counting employees for the threshold of six employees, you count part-time employees and seasonal employees as well. So that law would cover what you might call a three-chair barbershop if the barbers are part-time.
And to what time period would though that headcount be applicable? In other words, I could see where a company could have 12 employees 1 month and three the next month. Is there any averaging? Is there any look back on that?
I apologize. I did not see that in the regulation. I know that there is a qualification window under the federal regulation of 15 employees within a 20-week period. I'd have to defer to my colleagues to see if they know the answer to that particular question.
No, some statutes use a computation by going back, say, one, two, three, or four payroll periods and adding those employees that appear on those records that have been employed by, say, more than 20 hours a week or something. There's a lot of formulations, I think, that we can deal with, and I was just wondering what the state of Oregon has done on that at the regulatory level.
I'm not aware of the answer to that.
I currently, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I currently advise employers who ask me that question to defer to the federal statute because of the provision of the Oregon statute that says it should be construed to the extent possible to the ADA. And 42 U.S.C. 12111 sub 5 provides the definition that was just testified about regarding the 20-week work week provision. But I don't know if Oregon has a similar one.
I'm not aware of a similar one under
20-week. Is there any opportunity in this dispute for you to consult or negotiate with the Labor Commissioner regarding amendments of the regulations that might satisfy you in the terms of how you count up to six employees for the threshold purposes?
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to work with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and following, as we indicated, we want to listen to the opposition today and see, and I'm not sure if it's something that can be corrected by rule or if it would take a statutory change, but we're willing to certainly sit down and talk to them.
I appreciate your willingness to both negotiate on it if it's necessary, provide us with the information that we will need to make a decision. Any further questions from the committee to the panel? Okay, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
I'll call up the opponents. We have three. Denise Spielman from the Oregon Disabilities Commission, Annette Talbot, Deputy Labor Commissioner, and Lene Rutledge from the Department of Human Services. Mr. Wilson, did I miss you? I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Did you wish to have a few words?
Yes, Chair Ackerman, I was signed up on with the proponents, but I'll gladly say my piece and let my friends on the other side take the opposite view. We were supportive of the bill. Just to answer Representative Garrard's question, and it gets to why we support the bill. The definition of a small business in Oregon is 50 or fewer employees, and it really has almost no discernible impact in the state for anything other than probably public contracting. About 60% of the employers, I think it's about 59%, employ fewer than five, 77% employ fewer than 10, and about 89% employ fewer than 20. And when you're talking about, as Representative McPherson indicated, what level, how many employees statewide or what percentage of the workforce would be exempted under the proposal, you know, you have to consider that about 90% of the businesses that file with the Employment Department, that is businesses with 20 or fewer, employ about 25% of the workforce. So as a derivative of that, I would say when you're talking that threshold between 6 and 15, it's probably about 10-11% of the Oregon workforce that you're talking about when you talk about employers between 6 and 15 employees. Now, we support the bill because we've always supported proposals that that would provide a consistent application of state and federal law. For instance, the federal FMLA applies to employers 15 and greater, but in Oregon it's 25 or greater. You have the ADA, which is 15 or greater federally and 6 or greater statewide. And I think the disparity even between the state FMLA at 25 and greater and the Oregon state ADA, 6 or greater, when you're talking about basically a same set of concerns as was indicated in prior testimony, why some employers, why you're deemed better equipped to handle ADA when you're 6 or greater doesn't seem to be to make a lot of sense to us. So that seeking of consistency is what we're after. I want to impress upon you and convey just how small a business you're talking about when you talk about a company that employs 7-8 employees. I mean, that's a bread and butter small business, probably $350,000-$400,000 in gross sales and a small profit margin. So I'd like to impress that upon the committee and ask for your favorable consideration of the bill or anything that's worked out.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Questions from the committee? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you go over those percentages that you gave in the beginning about how many percent of employees, 10 or fewer?
It's from the number of employers in the state. Now, these are employers that actually file with the employment department. That is, they have actual employees and they pay those tax assessments. Fewer than 5, that's 59% of Oregon employers. Fewer than 10. It'd be 77% of employers, and fewer than 20 would be about 89%. And for that employee threshold of 0 to 20, I'm going to say that's about 25% of the Oregon workforce.
Thank you.
Yep. Fine, thank you. Further questions of Mr. Wilson? Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we'll have the three proponents or opponents come up, please. Once again, you can testify in any manner you wish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Denise Spielman. I am a commissioner on the Oregon Disabilities Commission. I am the chair of its Americans with Disabilities Act Committee. I am, in fact, missing part of our meeting this morning because it's so important for us to be here today and to talk about this bill. And to ask that you not pass this bill. Listening to prior testimony, it became quite clear to me that no one has said that the Americans with Disabilities Act is a civil rights law. No one has said that we are directly affecting people with disabilities in the same way that we don't discriminate against people because of their color, their age, their religion. Since 1990 and the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, we no longer discriminate in this country on the basis of disability, except that we do sometimes. You will see from the testimony that I gave you, Addendum 2, the last couple of pages, show you a state-by-state breakdown of the different states' requirements for the fewest number of employees that an employer has before non-discrimination and employment kicks in. 18 states plus the District of Columbia have said we will not discriminate against people with disabilities in the area of employment at all. Fully 70% of the states that have fewer than 15 as their requirement. That's 35 of the 50 say that it's fewer than 15 that they will support. When I read that this bill was proposed, I thought, why would anyone want to impact people with disabilities who are trying to work in a negative way? And the only thing I could come up with was money. It must have been that they thought that the cost of reasonable accommodations was outrageous and was a burden. The Americans with Disabilities Act clearly states that if it is an undue hardship for an employer to provide an accommodation, that employer does not have to provide it. What that means carries a lot of weight when you look at the kinds of accommodations that are normally asked for. By far, the overwhelming majority of requests offer flexible schedules. I have also attached in Addendum 1 the two tax breaks that employers can get for providing reasonable accommodations. One is a tax credit for small businesses, and that definition is 30 or fewer employees or $1 million or less in gross receipts. That's how small businesses can offset the cost of compliance with the ADA. But they can also take into account outside sources of funding, vocational rehabilitation, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Preferred Workers Program, the Commission for the Blind. All of those entities help offset the cost of reasonable accommodations if an employer can't pay for it. And the overwhelming majority of reasonable accommodations that do cost money cost less than $500. With the tax credit of $250 that they would have to pay, they can get the tax credit for that additional $250. There should be no reason that an employer should have to pay more than $250, unless, of course, the accommodation is going to cost more than $10,250. But those instances are extremely rare. After I looked at the economics of it, I just began to think about the fact that it just sends the wrong message about who we are as Oregonians. I walked into the rotunda today, and as I looked up, I saw chiseled in stone on the Capitol Rotunda, "In the souls of its citizens will be found the likeness of the state, which, if they be unjust and tyrannical, then it will reflect their vices. But if they be lovers of righteousness, confident in their liberties, so will it be clean in justice, bold in freedom." I would like to see Oregon be clean in justice, bold in freedom. I think that this is a mean-spirited law. I don't think it should be passed. Thank you for letting me testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Next witness.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Annette Talbot. I'm the Deputy Labor Commissioner for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I apologize the Commissioner couldn't be here personally to testify today, so I'm here in his stead. You have my testimony in front of you, Mr. Chair and members, and I think I can answer one of the questions that previously had arisen was how many Oregonians do we think that this would impact. And our formula that we've applied according to the Employment Department, it would impact approximately 155,000 employees who would no longer receive civil rights protection based on their disability and the fact that they happen to work for an employer with 6 to 14 employees. I would be glad to share the charts that I have, my only copy that I've got from the Employment Department, the pie charts about the sizes and percentage of employers based on 2004 data, so I'd be glad to share that. Unfortunately, the 6 to 14 size doesn't quite split out. They do 5 to 9 and 10 to 19, so we've had to do a little bit of a formula to derive the 155,000 employees. If the committee would like, we can ask the Employment Department to run a specific run, and they can get you the actual number. Which they weren't able to do for me late on Friday afternoon, but are willing to do if the committee would so like. I would point out that it is our research within the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, although I wasn't around in 1973, that this law was actually passed with the 6-person threshold in 1973. So it has been in place for 3 decades or more and preceded the Americans with Disabilities Act. While the law did change, as noted, in 1997, again, I was not with the Bureau then, but I have been told by staff who participated in that work group that they did want to mirror it after the ADA to the extent possible. But the 6-employee threshold, as one individual previously said, was not overlooked. I believe that there was a clear intention to maintain that threshold where it was at 6 employees to offer that protection because Oregon is a small business state in that respect. They did not want to disenfranchise the civil rights of that many employees. So that is my understanding, again, having participated in that 1997 work group.
For three decades, van employers of this size have been talking about and looking at how they address individuals they employ with disabilities. The Bureau did some research and found that less than 40 complaints a year are received under this state law for disability discrimination alone. So one can certainly draw a reasonable conclusion for that compliance is very high with the law. And we also know, though, that employers do have questions about how to accommodate individuals with disabilities. So we have a free technical assistance line where employers of any size can call in and ask for advice on how to apply employment laws, including this particular state disability law. I think the other thing that's important to mention that wasn't previously mentioned in detail was that employers do have the responsibility to make reasonable accommodations, but they only have to do that to the extent that it does not create an undue hardship for them. And while it took a while, I think, for case law to evolve with the Americans with Disabilities Act, there are clearly a lot of clearly defined disabilities now for employers to be able to seek advice and counsel from either the technical assistance unit of the Bureau or from their attorney if they so desire. The undue hardship provision says that an accommodation that would be unduly costly, extensive, substantial, or disruptive, or that would fundamentally alter the nature or operation of the business is not required. And as an employer myself, our employees ask for accommodations too, and it does take time and it does involve an interactive process. But I think the commissioner's point here is that we have benefited greatly from having a diverse workforce which includes individuals with disabilities, and it would be a shame to revert backwards 30 years to not cover these individuals who have worked very hard to contribute economically to their own well-being, their families, and their community by going out and working. So we would urge you to reject this proposed legislation. If there's something narrower that we could work on, and we would be glad to work with AOI and their other lawyers to look at the rule regarding the threshold of six or more employees. But as I said, it has been in place for quite a long time now, and I do believe that there is a reason for it and a clearly thought-out policy protection for civil rights of individuals with disabilities. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, please.
Hi, my name's Lene Wetlands. I have copies of my testimony. I'll bring them up. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lene Rutledge, and I'm the Policy and Program Manager for the Department of Human Services Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. So we work with thousands of people with disabilities and employers every year around making sure that people with disabilities can go to work. The testimony that you've heard on both sides of this issue, I think, are really compelling. You hear the issues from the employer's perspective and their attorneys. You hear the issues from the advocates for people with disabilities. We're talking about public policy, but I think you also get down to essential business issues. So what I did is I just gave you some real basic thoughts that we had, first around the public policy, but let me tell you the three concerns that we have about this bill. The first concern is that many people with disabilities who will be impacted by this bill have been successfully served by the Department of Human Services and are now working or seeking employment. If they experience discrimination as identified in this bill, they will come back to us for additional services and for other supports. The second is that the information that you're seeking around the number of employers that this impacts and the number of employees is available from the Employment Department. And Annette Talbot and I have worked together with workforce partners for many years, and we'd be glad to work together with you to get the information that you need around the number of employers and the number of employees that this impacts. But roughly, as we were looking at it last week, the number of employers that currently have six or more employees is 32,569. The number of employers that have 15 or more employees is 14,087. And the information about the number of employees that they employ is also available. But you're really impacting a large number of employers by reducing their requirements around non-discrimination. And as Denise Spielman had said, the other states within our region have been similar to Oregon in looking at protections for people with disabilities, because we in this region really are small business employers focused employment development. We don't have a lot of large employers. So when you look at Alaska's law covers employers with one or more employee. Idaho's law covers employers with five or more, and Washington's law covers eight or more. And Oregon, as you've heard, has historically had six or more. Given those concerns, the Department of Human Services opposes House Bill 2873, but we'd be more than happy to work together with folks to see if there's a way to address the issues that employers have, but also protect the rights, the civil rights of people with disabilities. Thank you very much. I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Fine. I appreciate your testimony. Questions, beginning with Representative Girard.
Ms. Rutledge, according to one of the sheets we have here, it says the cost of providing accommodations
mm-hmm.
on a national average is around $500.
Mm-hmm.
Does that come pretty close to Oregon?
Chair Ackerman, Representative, yes, it does. We have historically worked with employers around accommodation, and most often the costs of accommodation are extremely low. And so when you look at an average that was actually developed by the Job Accommodation Network, as they worked with employers nationally and have gathered those statistics over years, that's reflective of what Oregon's experience has also been.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Flores.
I'm sorry. I seem to be confused, so perhaps you could help me. And I think it's Ms. Talbot and Ms. Rutledge. Ms. Talbot, your figures indicate that, according to the data from the Employment Department, approximately 155,000 employees would be deprived of their or would be subject to discrimination based upon this bill. And then, Ms. Rutledge, you indicate that the bill reduces the number of Oregon current employers covered by these non-discrimination provisions from 32,569 employers that have six or more employees down to 14,087 employers. So is your 32,000 and 14,000 indicating that that's the 155,000 employees that Ms. Talbot refers to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I believe that there is a rough equation there. I'm not sure what year data Ms. Rutledge was relying on. I know ours was the first quarter of 2004, so we can certainly do a crosswalk because every quarter the number of employers changes, so it sort of depends on where that number was derived from. But I've given to the chair and committee council the pie charts, and I apologize, I only have one copy of them. So you do need to do a crosswalk between the number of employers, and like I previously mentioned, they don't break them down 6 through 14, which is exactly the threshold you are looking at here for this bill. So they can do a special run for us if you'd like, so we can actually get the exact number from 6 through 14 for their latest data, which I believe is 2004.
Thank you.
Fine. Further questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rutledge, would you agree with the characterization from the prior witnesses that Oregon has applied its disability statute more expansively than the federal ADA has been applied? I'm sorry, Ms. Talbot.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, although I've been practicing law in the employment field since 1989, I don't hold myself out as an expert on disability law. I can certainly get back to you on what our technical assistance folks would answer to that. But I do note that, as the previous speakers identified, there is a provision in the law that requires the court to provide, to the extent possible, an interpretation equivalent to the ADA law. I believe that the one previous case mentioned related to medical marijuana, and clearly there isn't a comparable ADA standard for that I am aware of. So since that's a state-recognized issue, if that's the issue that they're attempting to fix with this bill, I think that's a much narrower question and discussion, and we could certainly have our staff come in and talk about that particular issue. But it is the directive to the court to do
do that to the extent possible. And so that certainly would be what we would do as well as an administrative agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I did attach a handout that we provide through our technical assistance unit that does describe disabilities and how they're determined. It also provides the access to the information that Ms. Rutledge mentioned about the job accommodation network, which is a wonderful tool for employers trying to figure out what exactly the types of accommodations they might do for certain types of disabilities. So we refer people there constantly. They have a great website by disability that you can look up as an employer to help you determine that. In addition, one other thing I neglected to mention is that the threshold for injured worker discrimination is also at 6 or more employees in terms of the discrimination statute. So we do have somewhat of a balance there. When we get claims, we often get claims filed jointly under disability law and injured worker if the person has experienced an on-the-job injury. So would to change one without the other, I think, would create some concerns as well for the Bureau administratively.
Thank you, Ms. Talbot. I think I have about 3 questions. Okay. You note in your testimony that the Bureau receives about 40 complaints a year, I assume involving disability discrimination claims. How many of those are meritorious out of the 40 or so?
Mr. Chair, I was not able to do a file-by-file reconciliation of the cause, what we call the cause rate. When we find cause on a case, we estimate across the Bureau's number of complaints, which is about 2,000 a year, that we find cause in anywhere between 7 to 10% of our cases. So if you applied that same percentage to that 40 per year, you know, you would arrive at less than a half a dozen or so, I would imagine.
When you make that determination of probable cause or reasonable cause, whatever it is, that does trigger within your agency, does it not, a conciliation or negotiation process with the employer?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, it does. If we find a substantial evidence that the law has been violated, and we've engaged in this more recently, more aggressively, to try and settle these disputes with employers before they ever go through the administrative hearings process or, worst case, to court. So, yes, that is available through the Bureau.
And then there's been some comment about the current regulations, which aren't before us, and the determination of employment levels at 6 or more. Could you summarize that for us, or I'm going to ask you to provide some more materials later on, but if you have that before you, I'd like to hear how that works now.
Mr. Chair, the regulation in question for the state disability law is OAR 839-006-0205, and it defines an employer, which means any person that employs 6 or more persons, and doesn't include the Oregon National Guard, for instance. But that, it is my understanding, as the previous speakers noted, that we would include part-time and seasonal employees within that. But I do need to double-check that with our technical assistance unit, because the rule itself on disabilities doesn't specify that. So I'm sure they're relying on another section of the law. So
all right.
I'd be glad to get back to the committee.
Fine. Thank you. Any other questions for the committee? Well, thank you for your participation. I think what I'd like to do is not move this to work session and ask that first the parties consider if there's a regulatory solution to the seasonal part-time employee situation, and come back to us with that information as to whether you can make some sort of an agreement. And if not, I would certainly like to see the documents upon which the next presentation would be necessary if no deal is made, such as the regulations. Copy of the court opinions that indicate that the courts may be interpreting the ADA more broadly at the state level. And I think other information that I would have requested has been forwarded to me, such as a tax credit, which I did not know existed. And so I think that's my statement to the participants and to the committee, if there's no objections. Okay, hearing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2873. Thank you
Thank
for your
you.
Participation. on House Bill 2221. Counsel, will you explain this bill, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2221 establishes the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program in the Department of Justice, and it modifies requirements of programs funded by the CAMI program. This bill was had its first hearing before this committee January 24th, and some amendments were made to modify one specific provision that allows these multidisciplinary child abuse teams to receive information. It's mostly a technical change to better define what information they can receive. It was nothing that substantial as far as the bill is concerned. So we have dash one amendments that need to be adopted so that we can move this to full committee.
Okay, so we have to move the dash one amendments, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2221 to be adopted.
Representative Flores moves that the dash one amendments to House Bill 2221 be adopted. Is there any objection? Hearing none, it's allowed. And the dash one amendments are incorporated within House Bill 2221. Is there a motion on the bill, please, Representative?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2221 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2221 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Temporarily absent, but we'll call her back.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2221, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee of the due pass recommendation, and I will close the work session on that bill.
Carrier on that?
Carrier. Representative Flores, thank you. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2370. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2370 is the bill that requires a state medical examiner to issue a death certificate upon receiving information that a person is missing at sea and presumed dead. There were some amendments made to this bill. There were some dash one amendments, but what we're looking at is the dash two amendments. There was a slight modification that needs to be made to the dash ones. You should have the dash two amendments before you. They changed a couple of provisions on the original bill. First, extended the timeline from 30 days to 45 days that the medical examiner has to issue the death certificate, and it also define differently the information that the medical examiner may look at. The original bill was very specific relating to Coast Guard reports. This bill is broader. Says any information that the medical examiner deems credible. So those are the dash two amendments.
Thank you. I think this represents a compromise between the agency involved and the participants in the work session of the public hearing.
That's correct.
Okay, fine. Need a motion? Mr. Chair?
Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2370 be adopted.
Representative Torres moves that the dash two amendments to House Bill 2370 be adopted. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I can't find the dash two amendments.
All right. We have a mechanical problem, technical problem.
I can grab the copy.
We have not been given the.
They were on your place this morning.
Then I've simply misfiled.
Go look at mine.
Does anybody else need copies?
I've got mine.
I've got mine.
Okay. Actually, I was just delaying for Representative Worth.
Any discussion on the dash two amendments? The motion has been made to pass the dash two amendments. Hearing no further discussion, that's allowed. And the dash two amendments are incorporated within House Bill 2370. A motion on the bill, please, Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2370 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2370 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Burrell?
Aye.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
House Bill 2370, as amended, will be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I'll ask Chair Krieger to carry that bill to the full committee. Thank you. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2370 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2634.
A work session?
A work session. Thank you. Council, explain the bill and the amendment, please.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2634 establishes pleading requirements for actions against real estate licensees. A minor amendment needed to be made on this bill to correct some technical language regarding what actions were brought against real estate licensees. Those are encompassed in the dash one amendments.
I will move that the dash one amendments to House Bill 2634 be adopted. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, it's allowed. Chair will move that House Bill 2634 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
House Bill 2334, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. Further business before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.